Good morning and welcome to WGTD-FM and this our Saturday morning program, Community Matters. I'm Linda Fleshensky, the host for this week's edition of Community Matters. We are here today to discuss a very challenging and timely topic, the topic of sanctuary for immigrants. I can paraphrase from a website which summarizes the problem. For decades, immigration has been a contentious issue in the United States. During the U.S. presidential campaign of 2016, the political discourse changed when the focus shifted from arguments about immigration reform to attacks on immigrants themselves. Whether we are speaking of Muslim refugees from Syria or Mexican migrants seeking a better life, campaign rhetoric generated fearful images of lawlessness caused by these others who are seen by some as not belonging here. Today, to talk with us regarding the long history of sanctuary, the role of sanctuary today, the commitment their church has made to sanctuary, and how individuals and churches can work in solidarity with the undocumented community are our three guests, Reverend Dr. Tony Larson of Olympia Brown Unitarian Universalist Church, Diane Lang, a church member who spearheaded the church sanctuary study at Olympia Brown, and Valeria Reese, an immigrant and organizer for Voces de la Frontera. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us today. Let's start with you, Tony. For our listeners, could you provide sort of a definition of sanctuary and what it is and what its importance is in today's world?
Sure. The word sanctuary comes from the Latin sanctus, and it just means holy, a holy place. And in fact, if you grew up with the Latin Mass, there was a part where the priest would say, Sanctus, 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 holy, holy, holy. Because historically, sanctuaries or holy places often were places where someone could escape from harm, even the law. In the Middle Ages, for example, it was common for monasteries to keep someone there safe. And generally, the people on the outside, although they were not happy about it, didn't want to risk God's disfavor by breaking into a holy place. So because of that history, the word sanctuary came to mean a holy place in the sense of a place of safety. And that's how we get the idea of sanctuary movement today. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned the original meaning of sanctus because people need to understand, I think, that there's a spiritual dimension to this. Mm-hmm. And frequently holy places were places where God and earth met together. And so I like to think of sanctuaries today mm-hmm. as doing that too.
When we were doing our host shelter, the S in host was for sanctuary, a place for the homeless. It was interesting in reading about sanctuary this week that it has a very, very long history. Can you provide like some examples over history where sanctuary has been played a very important part?
Well, one of the biggest parts in our country has been the Underground Railroad. In our own Unitarian history, we have the Reverend Theodore Parker who would harbor, who would give sanctuary to fugitive slaves. And in the North, it was against the law to do that. If a bounty hunter came to return a slave to its master, legally you had to return that person even though slavery wasn't allowed in the North. And he kept a gun on his desk so that if anyone came trying to bring back a slave, a former slave, he wouldn't let them go. So there was a long movement of that, and many religious people participated in mm-hmm. that. And also in our own church, for example, we partnered with Cristo Rey Catholic Church at that time just to be a supportive church because they were giving sanctuary to someone from El Salvador at the time. That was a big issue.
It's interesting that often the people who are providing sanctuary are doing something that's technically illegal.
Yeah, right.
And you think of the people who hid Jews during the Nazi time, and is another example of the many sanctuary times that we've had.
That's
in
a
this
good
country.
Point. Uh-huh. A lot of times, to be religious and to do what you believe God wants, maybe to break the law.
maybe contrary to what the country or whatever mm-hmm. wants at
right.
that
well,
time.
Well, Martin Luther King being a good example of that, too. You break the law in order to bring attention. Mm-hmm. You're willing to take the consequences of the law, of breaking it, mm-hmm. but you want to bring attention to an issue.
And often it's nonviolent, mm-hmm. as in his case, as in Gandhi's case. Their actions are nonviolent but illegal mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. eyes of the government. Diane, you really spearheaded the effort at Olympia Brown Church to seek a way that we could help with sanctuary. How did that all begin? And you had a congregational meeting, I think March, was it? It was this spring, to talk about sanctuary. What happened at that?
Yeah, I think that we have to step back even a little bit further than that in terms of where this came from at our church and why I was interested in it. And it goes back to what Reverend Larson was saying with Crystal Ray, and back in the 80s and even the late 70s, there was a solidarity movement in Racine that was a part of a national movement, giving pushback to the government's role, our U.S. government's role in El Salvador and Guatemala and Nicaragua. At the time, we were sponsoring a war against people, and there were many Central American refugees coming to this country. And so I was a part of, learning about these and advocating and protesting some of those policies. Now, what's really different with the new sanctuary movement is that it's neighbors. It's people that have been living in this country for many years, working, paying taxes, having their children be a part of our community. And so it's part of the welcoming the stranger, which I think our faith, the Unitarian Universalists, have a long, long history of welcoming the stranger in our midst. And so for right now, our church got involved, I think, because it speaks to our faith, it speaks to our mission, that we have to find ways to take public moral stands for immigrant rights. So Voces de la Frontera in the Racine area, the Racine Interfaith Coalition are two local groups that I was able to be a member, that I am a member of, and they have many people involved in changing some of the injustices. So I brought that into helping to, form a committee that wanted to present it to our church. We had a church meeting, I think, at the end of January, where we entered into this process of discernment, which meant that we were meeting very often, talking about different issues, educating ourselves, hearing from people in the immigrant community as to how this was affecting their families, what it meant for them to be, to go to school in the morning and not know if your mother or father would be there in the evening, protecting our siblings that were so afraid of what was going on, which Valeria will speak more to. So we had a group of people at our church that studied this, paid attention to some of the other sanctuary movements going on in other parts of the country, and brought forth a resolution that we needed to look at what level of sanctuary could we provide with our resources in the community. We had small cottage meetings with people in the church where we talked about these issues. We had some readings that we were sharing. It was this process of really reflecting on what kind of action can we take. And through this process, we came to this decision that we recently voted on, that we would be able to be a sanctuary support congregation. So it's, it's a level of commitment that we will do, that we will take actions. We will walk with people who are being affected. We will try to accompany people in whether it's an ICE, meeting, Immigration and Customs Enforcement meeting that they have to report.
Or a court case, or to get mm-hmm. a visa, a passport.
That's right.
Just basically providing sanctuary.
And raising money. I mean, this is in common with other groups that are using, it's a racism type of base thing where many marginalized communities are being mm-hmm. affected. And right now the immigrants are part of that, but it's connected to so many other things that our church has also been involved in.
And it's kind of interesting because a lot of people came to that January meeting just wanting to vote that we'd be a sanctuary church that day. And in the process of discernment, we found that we actually couldn't be a Tier 1 sanctuary church because we didn't have the space and we didn't have showers. But we're at a level 2. Is that right, Diane? We're doing...
It's all part of the sanctuary, new sanctuary church movement, where maybe 2% of the immigrants may need actual sanctuary shelter, but the other 98% of the immigrant population has many other needs for support and for helping to raise funds, helping to challenge some of the injustices and these new quotas that are being given by the current administration to try to bring in undocumented people who have not committed a crime. They have only, because of reasons that they've had to escape economic problems, injustices, political violence, they have come to this country like many of our grandparents did. You know, they came as immigrants. So we have made stronger, we've been made stronger in this country over the years because of welcoming strangers, welcoming immigrants. And we need to get back with immigration reform to where we can have a reasonable policy and find ways to safely protect our borders, but also continue to grow our economy by using the strengths of all the people that bring their gifts.
There are a lot of reasons why immigrants come to the U.S., and many reasons sometimes make the situation difficult for them. With us is Valeria Reese. I said it wrong the first time, Reese, to tell us briefly her story and why she thinks that sanctuary is so important, what she sees in today's situation.
First of all, I want to thank you guys for inviting me to be here. I am an immigrant. I came to this country when I was 3 years old. I was born in Texcoco, Mexico, in Mexico. And my mom came into this country first, and then my dad and I followed. For many, coming into this country can take weeks. For my dad and I, it took months, because when we were in Baja California, still in Mexicali, still on the Mexican side, our money was stolen. So we had to wait there longer until we were able to come back into this country, and to this country. And when we were there, we were at a safe house. We were waiting for Los Coyotes to come and get us so that we can cross the border. And so that the night came, you know, they came, they knocked, they told us, come on, let's get ready, it's time for us to go. So my dad went to go grab my box of clothes. And as we were walking out the door, my dad was stopped, and he told them, you know, like, your daughter can't come with you. If she comes with us, she can die in the desert because she's 3 years old, you know. We can't, it's, you know, you have to be strong and cross yourself, and you won't be able to cross with your three-year-old daughter. So my dad took the decision to, I stayed behind with the woman that was in charge of the running the safe house, and so they crossed me a different way. And so for about 1 to 2 weeks, my mom nor my dad knew anything about me. They didn't know where I was, if I was okay or anything. Wow. So I finally came to San Diego with some relatives that I have living there. So they picked me up. I was there with them now. So I kind of was safe, but I still didn't know where my dad was. Mm-hmm. By then, my mom had already been notified where I was, so she knew where I was, but we didn't know where my dad was. Until one night, you know, they left me there. My uncles had told me, you know, where I'll be back. We're going to the store, you know, just a regular day. And I remember this day as if it was just yesterday when I was sleeping. And, like, it was those moments where you kind of wake up to just kind of position yourself in a different, you know, a different. And so I turned, and my dad was sleeping there with me. So it's a moment that I will always remember, because I remember that, you know, tears came to my eyes because I felt safe. I felt that I was protected again. I didn't feel alone. So then, you know, I came back, and we were in San Diego, and then we flew to Chicago, where I was picked up by my godparent. And again, it had been so long without me see and my mom that when we came to the house, there was a lady that was trying to take me away from my dad again. And, you know, I started to cry because I had just been reunited with my dad, and now there was this lady that was trying to take me away from him. So, and then, you know, this lady started to cry and to cry and to cry and to cry, and she said, "Don't you recognize me? I'm your mom." It had been so long that I had been separated from my mom that I couldn't recognize her that in that moment. And I know that's something that she's going to always carry with her, because she, you know, this is a sacrifice that that my mom and dad had paid. This is the price that my family has paid for us to be able to be in this country, and so that my mom and dad can give me the future and the opportunities, the education, the resources that they didn't have back home.
And have you lived in fear of deportation, or is that not an issue with your family?
It is an issue because I have DACA, so Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. I do have a social security number, a work permit, and protection from deportation, protection, because we've already seen other DACA recipients that have been picked up. One of them was picked up after speaking out, at a rally. She was followed home, and then they told her, you know, an ICE agent told her, you know.
She was deported?
She was detained.
Detained.
So she wasn't deported, and it's something that my parents, they fear, because I'm very publicly open. I'm very public in saying that I'm undocumented and unafraid. And
you
that
have
is
DACA
a concern.
Now,
yep, I have DACA now, but my parents don't. My parents are like many other immigrants in this country that are not protected.
So your parents could be.
Yes.
They're undocumented, so they could be deported.
Yes.
And is that's probably pretty common in the community?
Yeah, it is, because I come from a mixed status family. What I mean from that is my parents are, they're still not protected. I am a DACA recipient, and I have a soon-to-be a 10-year-old U.S. citizen sister. So we come from a very mixed status where we have all three statuses in our household, and it's very, and we've seen it in other cases where it's the same. Their parents are not protected, but their oldest children is a DACA recipient, and then their youngest being a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
So there's other cases just like that, just like mine, where we're in the same situation where we're protected, but we still worry about our parents. We don't know if they'll be home when we come home from work, from school. I don't know if my mom's going to be there when my sister gets off the bus. You know, what's going to happen if something happens to my parents, and then what's going to happen to my sister if something happens to me? Who will she stay with, you know? So it's something that it is it's still in the back of our minds that we have to be very cautious of everything we do, of every movement that we do, every place that we go, and we just have to live in constant, we have to be in constant alert of everything that's going around. And
And I understand you're very active with Voces de la Frontera.
Yep.
And there is a bill in going to Madison at the state level, AB 190. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about what AB 190 is?
Yes. So AB 190 is, it's actually worse than the 287G. Because 287G would turn sheriffs into ICE agents, but now what AB 190 will do is turn public employees, including local police officers and sheriffs, to act as ICE agents. So it's much worse, because now it's local police officers that would have this authority to do this, and it's pretty frightening, because I live like a block away from the police station. So I drive by there every single day. My mom and dad drive by there every single day. And it's like knowing that we have an ICE agent across the street from us. It's pretty alarming. And we also have police officers within our high schools. So it's like now we're going to have ICE agents within our high schools, where we have undocumented students present. We've been trying to pass the Safe Zone resolution that would do this to prevent collaboration between, in this case, Racine Unified School District and ICE. Mm-hmm. So what would happen if this bill were to pass? You know, what would happen with the schools being a safe zone, not only for immigrants, but also for our Muslim community, for our refugee community, for all those.
So you're going to be protesting in Madison. When is
it's
that?
It's going to be June 28th.
Okay.
In Madison, we at 12 p.m. So
at noon.
Yes. Okay. So there's going to be transportation provided. There'll be more information on the times the transportation would leave. But they definitely would leave from the Racine Labor Center.
Okay.
So we have that place set, but we have to figure out on like the times.
Okay.
That
and we would is there leave. A website people can go to?
Yes, the website for Voces de la Frontera is vdlf.org.
vdlf.org.
Just a little more information, if I might, on the AB 190.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the actual text for it is would prohibit city, villages, towns, or counties from enacting or enforcing an ordinance or a resolution or any kind of a policy that prohibits enforcement of the state and federal law regarding the immigrants. So it would basically allow the state of Wisconsin, to withhold revenue shared from any municipality or city. Mm-hmm. And even worse, it makes it, they call it a writ of manibus, I think it is, and it means that if you suspect that some municipality is not cooperating fully with ICE or mm-hmm. the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that you can, you have to report that to the local sheriff or the local district attorney. So it's basically trying to have us be spies on each other, which to me goes right back to, you know, Germany and how, you know, you were forced to comply with the Nazi regime. Or you would be punished.
Mm-hmm. Or the McCarthy era in this country.
Right.
Very scary. Right. So We've had sort of a de facto mm-hmm. kind of law, or de facto kind of action is maybe what I should say, that when the police stop someone for speeding, they don't ask their immigrant status. And pretty much that's what sanctuary cities, sanctuary states do. Mm-hmm. When they come to a public school, they don't say, are your parents documented or undocumented? So there'd be a really dramatic change, would there not, if this, because the same thing happening in Wisconsin, there's also a federal, you know, is moving up through the courts about whether people can be forced to work with ICE and report everybody.
Yeah. So for many of us, the resistance that's called for, you know, through our faith or mm-hmm. through working with people, once you start hearing the story of people being impacted, it reminds me of Jim Wallace, who is he's like the editor of Sojourners, mm-hmm. a national.
Right.
You know,
they've worked on this.
Yeah, summer. Very important mm-hmm. group. And he has said resistance is patriotic.
Right.
So whether you're speaking from your sense of patriotism and the shared values we have as a country, that mm-hmm. family is important, that hard work is important, that those shared values are being assaulted right now by the current Trump administration.
And I wish that everyone could hear that, because, you know, what people say to be the devil's advocate, a lot of people say, well, they're here illegally, so of course they should be sent back. Mm-hmm. How do we respond to that?
Well, I think that part of it is that our immigration reform, our immigration policies need to be reformed.
Exactly.
And there's been a struggle for decades as to how that's going to happen. There are different ideas that are out there, but that is like a really critical thing that needs to happen at the federal level. And we need to find ways to do that will protect our borders, make things secure. But right now, the current quotas that are being enacted are causing chaos with the security agents, because everybody all of a sudden is supposed to be getting deported. So people who are doing human trafficking or human smuggling, people who are bringing drugs into the country, people who are felons who are dangerous, that you know, Trump tried to scare everybody with, there are some legitimate people we do not want in our country.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, this crazy policy is just like, it's like using a shotgun rather than a single bullet, which is an intentional way that I'm trying to get people that maybe haven't thought about immigration policy and how it affects our country and how it's really undermining our values.
A lot of businesses are very opposed to all this too, because a lot of their workers, a lot of farmers might go out of business.
Yeah. We have a couple that we know that owns a very big business in Wisconsin, and they say if their workers are all deported, they're going to have trouble staying in business, honestly, because our Americans are not taking those jobs. They're not interested in going out in the field and picking more. Some of that. So it's a point well taken.
There's a statewide group called Wisdom, which is many different faith groups around the state that, that work with Wisdom. Our local Racine Interfaith Coalition is a member of that. And I went to the Action Day in Madison that they had. And there were immigrant workers who are involved in the dairy industry, who are involved in the hotel industry, who are involved in the meatpacking industry, who are involved in so many different jobs, landscaping, car, you know, things like just people who are doing important work to keep our society going. So it's going to have a huge impact on just our Wisconsin economy.
Well, and one of the arguments that, the Trump people make is that it's hurting our economy because they're taking away jobs from Americans. And, of course, what we hear from businesses isn't that way at all. Tony, say somebody calls our church or Sanctuary Support Church, and they're sort of seeking sanctuary. How will we respond to that?
Well, we would work. There's a whole national organization working for that. So we didn't vote to become a physical sanctuary, as you mentioned. We don't have the space or the showers. But we wanted to make this statement so that if there are churches that are willing to provide the physical sanctuary, we will help them. Meanwhile, though, as Diane said, 98% of what people need is not necessarily the sanctuary. It's all the other things. And it's sad to say this, but if an undocumented immigrant has to go to court or go somewhere to get a passport or whatever, if a white person is with them, they are treated better. It's an example of white privilege. And although I'm not happy that I have white privilege per se, I am glad if since I do have it, I think I should use it to help people. And I just think people need to, if they heard the stories.
I think so, too. If people knew the stories, if they knew your story, Valeria.
Right, as Valeria said,
and just breaking up families. I mean, give us, you're tired, you're hungry, your souls are yearning to be free.
On our Statue of Liberty. I mean, and I get that when people say, well, that should be legal. Well, we should be making a better legal system. The one there is now is terrible. And
you know,
it's hurting.
Something that's kind of interesting is that our recent presidents, Republican and Democrat, have talked for a pathway to citizenship. In other words, we're not just going to let them off the hook. They're going to maybe have fines. They're going to have to go through the process of citizenship. But that seems all just sort of wiped away in this discussion now.
I think also, Linda, getting back to your question, what if a group or a family needed sanctuary? Part of working with groups like Voces de la Frontera is that they actually have churches who are providing sanctuary in Wisconsin, so we would be able to help access those resources. They have a whole pool of immigration lawyers who are providing legal counsel, which is one of the most important things. If you're going to be successful in fighting deportation, you have to have good legal counsel.
Right.
So I'm hoping that's a role that our church can play in terms of helping to raise some funds that will help to provide, you know, either the fees for applying for DACA or getting a decent lawyer, you know, and some of the fees that you have to do for getting your passport or even citizenship, you know, tests and stuff. So all of that costs money. And so I see that as a way we can also be a support, you know, community through being this level of sanctuary support.
Also, one of the other things we can do, and all kinds of people can do, is provide rides for people who can't get a Wisconsin driver's license. Some states allow undocumented people to get driver's licenses. Our state does not. And if you're working or you're trying to bring your kids to school or whatever, what do you do? Do you risk driving without a license and maybe getting picked up and deported or not? And so so I think we want to change that law, but meanwhile, since we do want the undocumented immigrants to be safe, some of us will need to volunteer to be chauffeurs for this and that.
We do a lot of that, actually, with our homeless population, and it's volunteers who will take them to their court date or take them to medical appointments. And do we see ourselves as providing people to shelter someone? Olympia Brown, say one congregant says, I'll shelter this person who's
in fear. We actually do have people in our church who are saying, I have an extra bedroom in my home.
Right.
So, and that is another way that sanctuary churches can help to quietly. It is an act of civil disobedience, but sometimes laws need to be challenged because they're unfair, they're immoral, they're inhumane. So people are quietly looking at their faith and what does their faith call for them to do to respond to today's environment of hate and fear.
You know, we've talked about there are sanctuary cities and there's even, I think, two sanctuary states, California, maybe Colorado. But I think you've done, Diane, a little bit of research on a couple of those cities. Do you want to just say what sanctuary cities do?
Well, one that I'm familiar with is in Denver. And the First Unitarian Church in Denver is providing physical sanctuary, but there is a whole network of congregations in the Denver area who are providing support to them and helping to, you know, provide some of the monetary, some of the emotional support that a family needs. If someone is in physical sanctuary, they are basically in house arrest.
Right.
They cannot leave. They cannot go shopping. They cannot go to work. They can't go to teacher conferences at the child's school. So they need to be surrounded by people who can support them.
Mm-hmm.
The Unitarian Universalist, that First Church of Denver, has an excellent website that you can just Google and find out a lot of information.
Do you know that website?
No, but if you just go to the First Unitarian Church of Denver, you will get to it.
Okay.
And it's a great website. And there's like little bars that you can like pull down information on resources. And it links you to other cases, other immigration cases that are going on and resources. Another useful city has been Philadelphia. And Philadelphia has been providing sanctuary for over 7 years, I believe. I'm not exactly sure how long. But they've developed a very effective first responder type of network so that if there is an ICE raid going on, they have organized people who will respond and basically try to intervene, try to afford protection for the worker who's being raided at the workplace or, you know, wherever this is occurring. So we're currently working with Voces de la Frontera, who is working also with an immigration rights group in Chicago, and we're looking to get a training set up for people in Racine and Kenosha who are interested in getting a rapid response network started. So it's another reason why churches, you know, to do it individually, that we have people within our church who want to work, but we need guidance, we need training, so that we are really, truly helpful. Not just people of goodwill, but people who know how to be effective in really helping to provide that shelter and protection and advocacy.
Who are some of the churches we've talked to or worked with that maybe not technically partnering with us, but working with us?
I'm not sure I want to say.
Okay,
I just, without the church's
That's
permission.
True. That's true.
So I'm going to have to leave that. But,
yes.
But I do know of at least one other church that's involved, and there's probably quite a few.
And why is it so often churches and Unitarian churches that take up this call?
Well, I think that it's an interesting point. People think of this, they may think of it in terms of only breaking the law or something. But sanctuary, as I mentioned earlier, it means holy. It means giving a holy space. And there's a nice letter in Paul's letter to the Hebrews in the New Testament says, never forget to welcome the stranger, for some have entertained angels unaware.
Wow.
And it's the idea based on Lot letting the strangers into his home, and it turned out that they were angels. So that if we really thought of the people that the stranger, not as an enemy, but as the presence of the holy.
Mm-hmm.
So that's partly why so many churches have gotten involved, just as many churches got involved in the Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. and Martin Luther King's civil rights movement. Lots of ministers came to join from all different religions, came to join him in his march to Selma, and it's because they see that this is, if you really believe in a divine presence or God, if you will, this all ties in with that, and it's where a sanctuary originally was a place where earth and heaven met, and you think of the story of Jacob, who wanders and he gets a rock for a pillow and falls asleep, and he has a dream of angels walking up and down a ladder from heaven. And when he wakes up, he says, surely this is a holy place, because it was an intersection of heaven and earth. And if you think of giving sanctuary as an intersection of your highest values, your spiritual values, and the earth, It's a perfect match.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that. Thank you. I think also there's a history with the Unitarian Universalists that of being interfaith, you know, collaborators, that
right.
we really reach out and are feel comfortable. So, like, our church is an active member of the Racine Interfaith Coalition.
In fact, a founding member.
A founding member,
One of the eight founding right. members.
And RIC, as it's known, Racine Interfaith Coalition, or RIC, right now is doing really important work in two areas. One is criminal justice reform,
mm-hmm.
which gets at some of the racist right. ways that the system has evolved to really punish people who are already marginalized more. So the immigrant, what's happening to the undocumented immigrants is very similar in the sense that it's a racist at the very mm-hmm. core of it. So the Racine Interfaith Coalition is trying to do some good work along that line. And I see VOSAs also embracing more a wider
right.
network of people that are being impacted, whether it's the GBLT community or the Muslim ban, and the way religious intolerance is being mm-hmm. also ramped up. So there's many ways that we can connect the faith and the values and ways that things are being undermined mm-hmm. with the current
yeah.
system.
Yeah, one thing about Unitarian Universalists is they're generally very socially active. Mm-hmm. And somebody said that to me the other day. They said, oh, that's the church that does all this. We split our collections every month. I think it's amazing to give to other nonprofits who are working here.
There's a story in the Jewish Talmud that is just wonderful. The Talmud is our stories and teachings about the Bible. And it's important in the Jewish tradition. And the story is that there were two brothers. One was married and had kids, and the other one was single. And they owned a farm together, and each brother would split whatever they produced evenly between them. But one day, the brother who didn't have any kids thought, I don't really need as much grain as they do. My brother has kids. So he would secretly at night bring back some of his grain and put it in his brother's silo. And that brother said, I've got kids to support me in my old age, but my brother doesn't. So he would secretly bring some of his grain back to the other guys. And of course, at one point they met each other in between as they were going together. And what could they do but hug? And it said, the story is that God witnessed their embrace and said, this is a holy place. This is where I will build my temple. And so although people think of holy places as where God has come in, maybe God looks at what we do and says, this is a holy thing.
Beautifully said. I think for those listening who aren't in a church, you all you have to really believe in is justice and mercy. And also read about some of the stories like Valeria's stories.
Yeah.
And just see how families are threatened. I mean, what if your family, someone could be taken from you to sent away to another country? It's just got to be so hard to live with the kinds of things that the immigrants are going through. And ironically, all of my grandparents came from other countries as teenagers to the U.S.
Yeah, mine too.
Yeah, except for the slaves who were brought here against their will, and the American Indians were all descended from immigrants. And
right.
it seems like people would would think about that. What do you say to people, and our president was among them, who say that immigrants bring increased crime to our country? Is there evidence of that?
I don't think there's any credible evidence of that. I think that within any population, you're going to have some people that are on the wrong track, and I think there's a common thread that when inequality and poverty and injustice all come together, you're kind of fanning the flames that there will be some criminality. So our job is to continue to change the direction of our country, resist things that are unfair, try to pressure and advocate for a good immigration reform that, you know, allows people to become citizens,
right.
allows them
mm-hmm.
to be on the correct path, and then be harsh with people who are criminals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't
right.
we don't want them in our country. I don't think there's any disagreement
right.
on that in
no.
any of the areas.
And is that how you see that, Valeria? Is there a lot of... Well, actually, I read statistics that say that the immigrants who come here actually have a lower crime rate.
Yeah, in general,
actually,
that's actually
yeah.
true.
And
it's
some
actually,
of that, maybe.
It has gone down over the years.
One area, Linda, that just sort of fits in with this, maybe, is some of the reform right now, worker justice. Like, there's a group in Chicago that has a good web page also, and it's just called the Interfaith Workers for Justice. And they've done a lot with how there's been wage theft. And, you know, immigrants are set up for their wages being stolen
mm-hmm.
for, really terrible working conditions, and they're afraid to speak about it.
Right.
They get injured on the job. They're afraid to seek treatment or to
mm-hmm.
stay home and heal because they're very vulnerable because of the current population. So I think there's a lot of high-hazard work that different immigrants do get involved in. The dairy business is a great example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've read stories of people who have been damaged. I mean,
yeah.
like a cow has stepped on their hand when they're
yeah.
milking, and they're afraid to seek treatment. So there's a vulnerability there, too, that is part of the challenge for this whole puzzle.
This time has really gone fast. I think I'll just let each of you say one last thing briefly that you'd like people to know about immigrants in our country. Can I start with you, Valeria?
Something that I've seen a lot, and, you know, I also personally like that is this, you know, immigrants, we, you know, we make this country great. It was founded by immigrants, and, you know, if it weren't for us, we wouldn't have the diversity that we have now, all the cultures, the mix atmospheres that we have within our own community. And it's, you know, I don't want to be recognized or labeled as just an executive order or as a DACA recipient or as, you know, some just a label. You know, I'm a human being. I'm a person. I'm your friend, your neighbor, your student. And I want to be treated as like.
And
very well said, Valeria. Thank you, Diane.
And I think my final thing would be just with the 4th of July coming up to remember that resistance can be patriotic and that the Racine Interfaith Coalition and the Racine Coalition on Peace and Justice, the VOSAs, people from, you know, different groups are going to be marching in the 4th of July parade together because we believe that it's good to welcome the stranger into the community and that we can build peace together.
Very well said. Thank you, Diane and Tony.
I would just say this welcoming the stranger is the most spiritual thing you can do. And this is a holy thing we are involved in, and we have a lot of precedent for it. We have the Underground Railroad and the fight against slavery in the 19th century, and we have Martin Luther King Jr. Looking at the laws that were unjust. There were fountains called colored drinking fountains, or in Wisconsin, I guess we'd say bubblers, and for white, and people resisted and they broke the law, because it was an unjust law. And I believe that we are called to change the laws when we can, and the ones that are unjust, be civilly disobedient and resist.
Beautifully said. Thank you. Usually I end with a short quote, but today I'd like to read something by the Reverend Angela Herrera. It's called A Poem for Travelers. She's from the First UU Church in Albuquerque, and it was really written for immigrants, but it's actually for all of us who are on many journeys. This is a prayer for all the travelers, for the ones who start out in beauty, who fall from grace, who step gingerly, looking for the way back, and for those who are born into the margins, who travel from one liminal space to another, crossing boundaries in search of center. This is a prayer for the ones whose births are passing from darkness to darkness, who all their lives are drawn toward the light and keep moving, and for those whose journeys are a winding road that begins and ends in the same place, though only when the journey is completed do they finally know where they are. For all the travelers, young and old, aching and joyful, weary and full of life, the ones who are here and the ones who are not here, the ones who are like you, and they're all like you, and the ones who are different, for in some ways we each travel alone. This is a prayer for traveling mercies and sure-footedness, for clear vision, for bread for your body and spirit, for water, for your safe arrival, and for everyone that you see along the way. Tony was going to quickly sing something about journeying that we sing in the church, and yeah, it's from
Jalaluddin Rumi, okay. a famous Islamic mystic. Come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshiper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come yet again, come.
Wonderful. I would like to thank our guests today, Reverend Dr. Tony Larson, community activist Diane Lang, and Valeria Ruiz, for organizer for Voces de la Frontera, who are among the many who are standing on the side of love by working for safe arrival for those journeying on difficult paths. I'm Linda Fleshensky, and I hope that you will join us here at WGTD every Saturday morning for this program as we explore the important subjects that touch our communities, because as we all know so well, community matters. Take care.